Tuesday, August 4th, just after market close in New York. This is the Real Vision Daily Briefing. I'm Ash Bennington in New York, joined shortly by Mike Shedlock, also known as Mish Shedlock, a writer from thestreet.com. This is the point of the intro where I usually tell you about Jack's intro, but unfortunately today, due to the storms here in New York knocking out power, we're rolling without an intro. Jack will be back shortly. Welcome, Mish. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, pleasure to be on Real Vision. Looking forward to our conversation today, Ash.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. You know, Mish, I've been reading you, pretty regularly for weeks now. You've got a really data-driven approach to the way that you think about markets, the way you look at the news cycle. And I find it just really engaging because you're really crisp with your data. There's almost always a single chart that really sums it up nicely. And it's going to be a pleasure to walk through some of the work that you've been doing now in the last few weeks.
Oh, my pleasure to be on. What are we discussing today? Gold, perhaps? I just did a report on gold.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Mish, how could we start with anything other than gold? Up over 2,000 right now. I know you had a chart on the website, gold 8 weeks without a loss. And then after that, you followed that with a chart today that's the gold COT, the commitment of traders chart that shows the bullish sentiment and that print over 2008 on that last chart.
That's a real interesting chart. People talk about short squeezes in gold all the time, and they invariably get it wrong. They keep talking that, well, the commercials are going to cover, they have to cover, the commercials are this or that much short. But the commercials are really two groups of people. One is the producers. The producers are those that mine gold, and they sell it via futures. So they are always short gold. And then there's other commercials who are users of the metal. Those are like the jewelry makers. So they tend to be long gold. And then we have the broker dealers, the JP Morgans, Morgan Stanley, you know, the broker dealers, they take the other side of the trade. And it's typically the other side of the trade of the managed money, of the futures, of the hedge funds, of the little specs, of the small guys. The short squeeze does not develop from the producers or the commercials. If there's going to be a short squeeze, it's going to come from the position of managed money. So, and I talked about that today. And although managed money and the hedge funds are net long, a couple hundred thousand contracts or more, there's also a component out there that's been short in gold this entire route. It is 100,000 contracts short. And if there's a short squeeze, that's where it's going to be. But the interesting thing about the COT chart to me was as gold has risen, normally what happens is gold typically rallies as the hedge funds manage money, as speculators are adding contracts. This time, gold has actually risen with managed money, the hedge funds, being less long than before. So I talked about that in my post today. At some point, I do think fear of missing out, FOMO, is going to kick in. And then also at some point, these people, the people that have missed out the rally and have shorted, are going to have to cover their shorts. That's what's going to drive the short squeeze, not the commercials being short.
Right. So basically, you're saying it's a speculative phenomenon. The shorts are going to get squeezed out here. Hedge funds who have been experiencing a little bit of FOMO as that price has continued to rise. What do you see the potential upside momentum to look like on that trade?
I don't know. And I'm asked that question all the time, Ash, and my answer is always the same. I don't know. There's times to be long gold. There's times to be out of the gold market. I tend to have a position in gold always, no matter what, because you never know what's going to happen. But the worst time for gold is in a period of disinflation, when everyone believes the central banks have things under control. The best two examples of this that I can come up with, and I've talked about this repeatedly, is during the Greenspan years. It was called the Great Moderation. People had a lot of faith in Greenspan that he could do no wrong. Gold fell from 850 all the way down to 250. in what was called Brown's Bottom after Chancellor of the Exchequer Gordon Brown, the UK liquidated their gold right at the bottom, and that's actually what made the bottom back in 2000. But the other notable instance was in 2012. You know, gold was 1800 off of a high of 1900. And ECB President Mario Draghi came out with an announcement: we will do whatever it takes to save the euro, and believe me, it will be enough.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is the ECB didn't do anything except for make that statement. They did not get into any QE or anything else until actually years later. But that statement alone put faith back in that central banks had things under control. And if we look at what's happening now with the various repo crises we've had, it's pretty easy to see that central banks don't have things out of control. And in fact, they're openly meddling now in fiscal policy with recommendations to Congress.
Yeah, I was going to say, hey, Mish, talking about other things you've covered, Thomas Barkin and Neil Kashkari, two Fed presidents coming out the same week calling for additional stimulus. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's not surprising, actually, given what's going on. But the Fed has been complaining for years about Congress or presidents, especially Trump, meddling in monetary policy. What is the Fed now doing but meddling in fiscal policy? They're telling Congress, hey, you know, we need more free money. That's essentially what it amounts to. Now, you know, there's reasons for it. I can discuss the pros and the cons of it. But for the Fed to be two consecutive Fed presidents just meddling fiscal policy from Congress doesn't happen a lot. I expect we're going to see more of it. It's an unsettling message, actually, to gold, or it's actually good for gold. Free money is, you know, debasement of the dollar, which is now going down a little bit. But, the big story here is that central banks don't have things under control. I believe that is the real message here behind gold and these two Fed presidents coming out, you know, yapping about, you know, more $600 weekly checks. You know, we're paying people more money to be unemployed than they were making when they were employed. Now, this is something that Trump and the Republicans wanted to fix. But the Democrats, of course, don't. But, you know, what's going to happen if we cut them off cold turkey? Maybe there's a middle line in here somewhere. The problem is, if we can just get into congressional policy here, we've had months of delays for Congress to figure out what to do. And unsurprisingly, they did nothing. So now they're bickering over it as the monetary stimulus ran out. And that's what's prompted the Fed to say, hey, guys, turn on the spigots.
So Congress can't come to an agreement, business as usual there. You know, Mish, something else that I'm looking at based on your writing from August 1st is the fact that personal consumption expenditures and real disposable personal income are moving in opposite directions, which seems paradoxical.
Yeah, that was an interesting chart I put up. And normally, income goes up, spending goes up. What happened here with COVID is for a number of weeks, we had these stimulus checks going out. People were getting $1,000 checks, actually, whether they were even impacted by COVID or not, providing their income was under a certain level. It was $99,000. I think the new level they're talking about now, Congress is bannering around now, is $95,000. But what people actually did is took a lot of the stimulus money and they paid down credit card debt. And of course, that is exactly the opposite of what the Fed wants to do. The Fed always wants more credit, more money, more monetary creation, more spending, more debt, which is what it all boils down to, despite the fact that they keep trying to pump more and more debt into a system that's already overloaded with debt. And we've hit a point where actually, I think consumers are looking ahead. They're afraid of the time that's going to happen when this stimulus money is going to run out. And indeed, it has. And so we're waiting on Congress now for another package. Congress has been very dysfunctional. They've had months to plan for this, and we're still bickering. McConnell is bickering with Pelosi, who's bickering with Trump. Meanwhile, some people who really lost their job and can't find a job at all are on the verge of having the stimulus checks cut off.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Yeah. So once again, talking about business as usual, both sides blame each other and nothing gets done. You know, it really feels almost, Mish, the situation you're describing here is a damned if you do, damned if you don't circumstance. You have people who are without income through no fault of their own. And then at the same time, you have the stimulus effectively causing distortions in the way that markets function. So, you know, on the one hand, you have a great deal of sympathy for these people who are out of a job through no wrongdoing of their own, through no fault of their own. But at the same time, you have these weird imbalances, inequalities, paradoxes that are building up in the system as a consequence of this exogenous stimulus.
Yeah, it's really quite something. There's millions of people, maybe 15 or 20 million people who are making more unemployed than they did employed. Meanwhile, we kept all of the nurses, all of the essential services, all the grocery food workers. I mean, you know, they still had their job and they're looking at people not working, making more, you know, than they did. There's an inherent unfairness to that people see. And rightly so. I mean, this is an argument that I agree with the Republicans on, you know, in principle. The problem is, you know, there's also a number of people who are out of work simply because government came along and said, hey, we're closing shop. You can't even leave your house, essentially. Don't go anywhere. Don't do anything. They wear a mask, and I think we should wear masks. So I'm not criticizing wearing a mask. I'm just trying to convey an attitude of how, you know, people are seeing this and viewing it as unfair. So, you know, so they were told that they can't go to work, that their business was not essential, that they're shut down. And so they were shut down. And some of these people, many millions of them actually, you know, have no job to go back to. So they're going to look at Congress saying, well, you know, you're shutting off my benefits here now because of the bickering. You know, so, you know, there's a number in there that sort of makes sense. But meanwhile, the way Congress works is it's all or nothing. Both sides get what they want or nobody gets what they want. And that's where we are now. That's what the Fed is worried about. And actually, rightfully so. But it just comes across as weird when they start interfering, like we've discussed, in fiscal policy.
Yeah, it's unusual to hear Jay Powell, for example, in his testimony saying, hey, guys, we need help, basically. I mean, that was really the simple message.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, it is this sense of it's hard to blame the central bankers for wanting more support because it's just not forthcoming. And a lot of this stuff is meant to be done on the fiscal side.
But we can blame them for a lot of things. And, you know, they try and absolve themselves. It's like, you know, Bernanke, you know, I don't know if you remember, what is it? We saved the day, or we did it. I forget the headline that we saw back then that was really nauseating to me, because it was the Fed policies that got us into this mess. Now, we can't blame the Fed for COVID. However, we can blame them for blowing three consecutive bubbles of increasing amplitude over time. We had three bubbles in 20 years, in 2000, in 2007, and now. So, you know, 8 and 12 years apart. You know, it's crazy. They don't see it that way. The Fed complains all the time about income and wealth inequality, but the Fed is the number one creator of income and wealth inequality. They created this mess.
Yeah, there's no question that skyrocketing asset prices caused by monetary stimulus have certainly exacerbated to an enormous extent the income inequality that we have in this country. I was just saying, you can't blame the Fed for telling Congress to get its act together.
Right. I agree with you on that. It's just because they've complained about Congress interfering in monetary policy, they've opened themselves up to exactly what I said, you know, complaints of Congress saying, you know, hey, you know, you're interfering now in fiscal policy. It's not a good thing for this to be happening. Let's put it that way.
Well, central banks don't like being criticized by Congress, certainly. So I suppose good for the goose.
Hey, let's talk a little bit here about inflation and tie that back in. I'm a deflationist, and I talk about it, and I say, well, we've blown these bubbles, and bubbles are inherently deflationary, and I don't know how anyone can argue against that, but they do. And I'm misconstrued all of the time, because, you know, Mish is an idiot because he doesn't see inflation. Actually, inflation is everywhere, and it's rampant. It's in home prices. It's in the asset prices. It's in prices of stocks and bonds. That's where the inflation is.
Well, let me just quote
you. It's not in the CPI, but the CPI is a fatally flawed measure. The CPI doesn't even include housing in it. And I'm working on a chart, and hopefully I'll have it out again next week. I've done these a couple of times before, where I substituted housing prices for owner's equivalent rent in the CPI. In my head, I already know what I'm going to see. I'm going to see the most negative real interest rates the world has ever seen right now, with home prices still going up, the demand destruction here of COVID. It's really quite amazing. That's where the inflation is. And these bubbles always pop, and the Fed has blown another one.
So let's run on screen right now the chart that you did on July 31st, PCE and real PCE 2012 to 2020. And let me quote you here. You'd say, these indexes supposedly measure inflation. They do nothing of the kind. The indexes do not include home prices, only rent. The purported medical inflation is a joke. Anyone who buys their own medical insurance will tell you their costs are rising more than 5.9% a year. Anyone in college has not been pleased with the rising cost of tuition and the rent in college towns. And anyone with an ounce of common sense knows the current stock market bubble is a measure of inflation.
That's exactly right. And here, so I use the word deflation, and I'm talking about, you know, asset deflation. And actually, I think we're going to have price deflation. I don't know. Maybe they've printed so much now that we don't see it. But the demand destruction here now off of COVID, and the demand destruction that comes when bubbles pop, is really quite amazing. You know, those are inherently deflationary forces. That's what I'm talking about. But when you use the word deflation, you people tune out everything else you said about it. Even though I'm generally in their camp that inflation is way understated at the moment.
Yeah. You know, talking about of things that people are struggling with from the opposite side of the equation, from price stability, You did a chart a couple of, I guess, about a week or 10 days ago, where you stated that over 62 million people had no paycheck last week. That's consistently above, or considerably, I should say, above the consensus estimates. Walk us through that number, how you got to 62 million and why that's something we should be concerned with.
The Census Bureau produces charts, and they just started this process about, I think we're in our 13th week now, coming up tomorrow.
These
surveys come out every Wednesday. And, you know, it's on how people are handling to COVID, and they ask various questions. And it's very similar, actually, to the household survey that determines the unemployment rate that the BLS does every month. And for that, the reference week is the week that contains the 13th of the month. But, you know, I was going through that, and I just totaled up, you know, all the people who said they had no money coming in at all. And it was a shocking number to me. And it's just right there. So there's 30 million people that are getting COVID benefits of some sort. They're dipped below that. We've been between 30 and 32 million people for like 9-10 weeks in a row, something like that. So call that 30 million. And then this 60 million figure, you know, just really hit me. Now that, you know, there are people on disability that are included in that. I need to go through that number, actually. And there were actually, I think, 5 million people, perhaps. I didn't report on that number, who said they weren't working because they didn't want to. So I need to go through and subtract out all of those. But when you look at this 30 million people that are getting these checks, you know, bear in mind there's a whole number range of people who are you know, working part time. Maybe they didn't apply for these. They didn't think that or not working at all and just didn't think they were eligible to get this. There's a lot of ignorance out there. So there's some number of people, and I don't know what it is, that's in excess of the 30 million people who are getting these checks. I don't think it's as high as 60 million, but I don't know what it is. But it was like a shocking number to me that 62 million people, and that number does not include people who are retired. I subtracted those out of the number. As otherwise, it was around 100,000 people had of working age had no money, said they had no money coming in at all. And then I'm looking at states whose uninsurance benefits are about to retire or about to expire. Excuse me. There's four or five states that only offered 16 or 20 weeks of unemployment insurance. All of those people, unless Congress does something now, are going to have no money coming in because they didn't extend these $600 pandemic checks.
Yeah.
So it's going to be interesting to see how many people, you know, get foreclosed on or at least started, you know, totally stop paying on their houses or rent without being any forbearance plan. Those numbers are about ready to jump unless Congress acts like right now. As of a week ago, actually.
Yeah, as you point out, the PUA has already rolled off under the CARES Act, and they need to either re-up it or it's already into the period for which people are not getting paid.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Yeah, state unemployment. You know, they said that it expired January 31st, but, you know, that's really a technical date. The state's unemployment benefits and It's typically on Saturday. There was one state that was Sunday. So as of July 25th, one state, I think it was July 26th, benefits expired. So, you know, here we are. People have lost a weekly check already. It's going to get serious here very quickly now, I believe.
Yeah. And, you know, one final chart, July 31st, you also wrote a piece and you quoted a job warning lights flashing. And you have a chart, continued state unemployment claims in 2020, where you see this bend up in the arc. You see it peak at around 25 million, almost even 24.9. And then it rolls down very gently to 16.5. And then it rolls back over upward 17 million on people filing these claims.
Yeah, that's easy to explain, and I think it's going to continue. What happened, this is due to states going into reverse. Florida opened up, Arizona, Texas opened up. Some of these states never really closed down or not so much as other states, say like, you know, Illinois or New York. But when COVID went into reverse, when COVID started increasing again, these states backed off, and we saw the rise then of the continued benefits. And so we kind of stabilized for a while around 17 million or so, plus another 15, 12 million. That's add those two together, and you get your 30 million people who are receiving the checks. And, that's about ready to run out here. When I first posted that chart, someone told me that 30 million was double counting. It's not really double counting. It's people are either on a state program or a federal program. They can't be both, and they have to apply first to the state level. However, what is double counting, and the reason why the official unemployment rate is so low, is a lot of these people on pandemic insurance that are getting these checks maybe worked 5 hours, 10 hours, whatever. So in contrast to state unemployment programs where you have to be totally out of work, the pandemic portion of this, 12, 15 million people were allowed to collect if they were working part-time. So it's not really double counting, it's just adding X and Y. And that's the reason why based on the reference week, I'm expecting the number of unemployed in the next job report, which is going to come out first Friday of every month. I'm expecting it to show about 17 million unemployed, but there's another 15, 12, maybe even 17 million people who are partially employed, working very few hours as a result of the renewed lockdowns.
All right, Mish, so what does it all mean? Let's bring it all together. We've got these challenges in labor markets. We have problems with managing stimulus. We've got dysfunction in Congress, no surprise there. And we've got asset markets gyrating around. You know, right now, the S&P closed today at 3306. It's like 2.5% down from an all-time high of 3393 intraday. That doesn't sound to me like an asset market that reflects the gravity of the pandemic or the economic problems that we've had as a consequence.
Not at all, Ash. It's the biggest disconnect in history. I've called a number of things right, and I've called a number of things wrong. And one of the things I've got wrong, I never thought that this bubble would get this big again. And certainly, from March till now, I did not think we were going to make a new high here. So, calling the economy is a lot easier, in my opinion. Although the economists are wrong all the time, I've generally been reasonably correct, or at least in the ballpark on that. Certainly on interest rates, which I've been calling for lower and lower and lower. But we had a huge disconnect. And what the Fed has managed to do, and they want to do, actually, they just can't come out and say, hey, we want you all to speculate in stocks. They can't really say that, but that's the message, and people are doing it. And Ash, it works until it doesn't. And, you know, I don't have any insight into when this is going to stop working. And, you know, people claim they know. This gets back to what you asked me about gold. You know, what's your target? I don't have a target. I can just see, you know, what the Fed is doing. I can tell you that I'm positive it's going to end badly. But I would have said the same thing. I did say the same thing 2-3 years ago, probably. And here we are, you know, the stock market going well beyond where I thought it would get. It's a matter of being prudent or not prudent. And I think a lot of people are going to get burnt by this, especially the millennials here now, who are one part of what's going on here. They've got this Robin Hood app. I've got millennial friends that were never interested in the stock market, but they are now. They're going out there. They're you know, day trading these stocks in bigger and bigger and bigger amounts. And that's who's going to get burnt by this. It's certainly not the you know, the hedge fund managers who are, you know, taking money off the top. It's people plowing in right at the very end. That are get burnt by this, and also the retirees are going to get burnt by this. I side with Hussman, if I can throw out a name. He thinks the stock market's going to decline 50% from here. Actually, 80, I think, is his number now. And he's been saying that for several years, and so have I. And you either, you know, you look either foolish now or you look foolish later. But I just don't believe it's wise to invest in what I believe is speculative bubbles. So I'm setting it out in cash, in treasuries. Some people call those bubble, but I don't think so. And in gold and miners. So that's how I'm playing it. That's not advice. I'm just saying what I'm doing. Because we don't know when these bubbles pop, and I just don't want to participate in them.
I heard if you bought stock on your iPhone, it couldn't go down. That's not true.
That's actually the message. You know, I have people telling me, well, it always comes back. It always comes back. It always comes back. Let's look at Japan. If we want to leave with a final thought of what, I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm just saying it can happen. The Nikkei fell from over 40,000 all the way down to 8,000 over the course of over 30 years. It's, you know, is it going to come back? Actually, I expect it will now, but not in any of these people's lifetimes. And for somebody who's retired and is throwing more and more and more into equities because the treasury yield is so low, chasing this rally higher and higher, those are the people who are going to get burnt, and they're going to get burnt big. No one can tell you when. Certainly, I can't. I wish I could.
Well, you know, the Nikkei is the ultimate cautionary tale. I think it peaked at around 39,000 in October of 1989, and it is still stuck today at 2753. Mm-hmm. So it's a truly secular stagnation, generational sort of lost generations with an S, not the base case here for the U.S., obviously, for very different reasons, very different economy, very different structure. But the idea that it cannot happen in an advanced economy simply isn't true. It has happened.
That is correct. I think we're going to see it, perhaps not to that same extent. Our demographics are different than Japan's. By the way, I actually fundamentally I like Japan just because I think they are going to get out. They're going to escape their demographic deflation at some point. At some point. I mean, and we don't know what the trigger is going to be. And there doesn't even have to be a trigger, but all of a sudden attitudes change. All the people in Japan that are xenophobic, they don't want people coming in, they don't want to have kids, whatever. All of that's going to change at some point. And meanwhile, the U.S. is still on a very deflationary piece of a of a demographic transition here. We're having fewer and fewer and fewer kids. We might be following Japan with a lag, albeit with some differences that you mentioned. But I think Japan's going to bust out of its deflationary impact ahead of the U.S. We'll see. That's one of the things that I've been watching.
Mish, great conversation. Any closing thoughts in the last few moments?
That said, readers might want to know how to get a hold of me. They can do so at thestreet.com/mishtalk. And please tune me in. I do 3 or 4 posts every day, 7 days a week. And actually, Ash, I do not believe I have missed writing a post a single day since March of 2003. I've worked continually every day. Now, on Christmas, it's just Merry Christmas. On New Year's, it's Happy New Year. But actually, I believe I've gotten something out on my blog. It's gone through Blogger to my own on WordPress and then to the Maven and now to thestreet.com. But I've been writing about stock market, the economy, gold, interest, all from an Austrian point of view, every day since 2003. That's a pretty long record there, I think, Ash.
Mish, quite a streak. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure to be on Real Vision. I look forward to the next time.